And we are back. Welcome back to another edition of the Daily Dots. And as always, joined by the Brain Trust, Mr. Chase Taylor. Not a lot going on today. I don't really know what to Dow had a good day. We don't talk about the Dow for obvious reasons. S&P was up 0.9.
Yeah, 0.86. Q's 0.36. And IWM over 2%, 2.18. So small caps had a big rampathon there.
Pullback in rates probably had a part to do with it.
There's a new high for IWM as well.
Where would the dollar do? New all-time high for IWM?
No, not all-time, but new kind of like miniature.
Yeah.
Last couple weeks, few weeks high.
What?
Dollar literally flat. And then yields were down 2, 3, 4, 5 basis points across the curve. So pretty good day for bonds. Oil flat. And to me, the big one for the day was gold being up 1.6%. Just a big move up for gold on the day. And another one that, like, and this is so important to me, like, you can't really point to something and be like, here's why gold went up 1.6% today. And whenever you can't point to something, in my opinion, it makes it much more important of a signal. And that's the stuff you should, in my opinion, you should be buying is the moves you don't understand.
Yeah. I think people will probably get caught up in the move on the Dow today. I wouldn't. There's a weird relationship that's been going on, and it's funny because it actually replicates our portfolio. But I think that the move on the Dow today was nothing more than Boeing and Apple going up. Why Boeing? Well, I think that there's just I think you're going to continue to get false reads on this market due to cross factor issues and all that other kind of stuff. The other thing that you've noticed is there's been a very, very pronounced pattern that on good days for the NASDAQ, especially relative to the other indexes, usually Apple's getting smacked.
Yeah.
On bad days for the NASDAQ on a relative basis to the other indexes, usually Apple's doing well.
Yeah, Apple's like almost like the IWM of NASDAQ now.
Yeah, and for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
Like, I think a lot of people see what we see, which is, look, idiots might go in there and bid this thing up higher, but there is no growth story. And this thing's, the valuation on the thing makes no sense. And not telling anybody to go short it, not telling anybody to go out and sell it either, right? Just
know what you got.
Yeah, I don't think it is, but I think that you could make a meritorious argument for why Apple might be the most overpriced of all the Magnificent Seven. I think you could make that argument.
Yeah, I don't disagree.
Yeah.
Speaking of overpriced, Nvidia was down another like 2.5% today. So we're actually at a 4-day low, which feels like pretty significant for Nvidia.
Yeah,
it's kind of a rough couple of days here. So
it's a bear market.
You know, it's down on the week, and let's see if I can find the last week we actually had a down week. You have to go back to basically the first week of the year,
1967.
So yeah, so Nvidia's had, just monster green candle one after another, and for the moment. We got a red candle for the week, so and only one more day for the week with Good Friday coming up. So
S&P closes another record high, 52.48. Again, I think it's really hard to make a bullish argument here, a bearish argument here. I mean, in the short run, nothing would surprise us. Although I will say that these kind of moments where you break to new all-time highs and then kind of gather and then try to break past that, you kind of struggle. Those signs throughout the cycle, that has always been, again, I don't want to use words like always. It's too hyperbolic. But in my recollection, those have been breakouts. Those have been signaling breakouts. You know, and every time it happens, you have the bear bull debate. They're like, well, it hasn't broken out yet. You know, it hasn't broken out yet. Anytime it feels like we get around these ranges where we struggle and it's kind of a fist fight, it always has felt, you know, you bust higher.
Yeah. It's letting you know where the liquidity cycle is every time.
Yeah. It's just going to force feed it up, you know? And that's why I think we're still in that reality of, yeah, you could have bouts of volatility. You probably will. But the other incredible thing here, and I don't know what to make of this just because I think that there are so many unnatural things going on in the market right now for a lot of variety of different reasons, but volatility across the board has collapsed.
Yeah.
It has collapsed. I mean, you got the VIX at 12.5.
And the crazy thing is, it's not just
7.5.
Not just volatility, but even things like implied correlation. So like correlation's like hitting shocking lows. So you have vol hitting crazy lows, and equity vol versus fixed income vol or FX vol is like putting in multi-year, if not multi-decade lows on a relative basis. So
have we looked at, have you done, and I hate the comps, like just anytime somebody, let me just save you some money. Okay. I'm just going to save everybody some money here. The next time you see a chart where they're overlaying the S&P 500 over the previous lead up to a market disaster, like 1929 or 1987, just immediately dismiss it. And that's probably a sign to get longer, right? Just because, and there's some good reason for that. A, when you're seeing that, so is everybody else. It's common knowledge. And B, I think this is a much more concrete reason. The exact same scenario could end up playing out always, right? Like you got to keep your mind open to that. Things never happen exactly the same way again. They just don't. And that's really anecdotal. And I know that that's not really satisfying to those who want a more, you know, meaty, you know, intellectual type answer, but it just doesn't ever play out like that, does it?
Those analog charts are the worst.
Yeah, they're the worst.
It's not to say I've never done one, but I've never done one without a giant cautionary, like, hey, these are stupid, but yeah, this one's interesting. Like, because they are just, and there's a lot of the doom peddlers on Twitter that really love to go and use those. And it's very annoying.
Well, because I mean, there's nothing that can get around social media quicker than some really solid bear point. Yeah,
these two lines look a lot alike, and yeah, this one went down. So clearly this one's going to,
it
right?
Must. Yeah. Yeah.
Never mind the fact that you only get one of these about once a decade, and you can make those two lines match up almost every year.
Or never mind the fact that the government wasn't running 7% deficits at the time. That other way, yeah, like, right?
Or your two y-axis are like wildly different scales. But hey.
Yeah, hey, but it looks good. It looks good. Well, the one I love the best is when somebody posts one of those and they get busted. You know, like the chart where one's log, one's not. Like it's right. Just, you know, the mental gymnastics trying to make the lines work.
I just wish people would follow up like 3 months later and say, yeah, that turns out, no, that was wrong. Like we're still blasting off the new highs because follow up never happens.
Well, that's like, you know, I call that the, what's his name? Mr. Permabear, even Bitcoin's garbage, gold's the only way to go. Peter Schiff. Peter Schiff. Yeah. That's the old broken clock theory, right? Like sooner or later.
Yeah.
By God, sooner or later. I met him in person, by the way, at one point.
Same. I a couple times actually.
Yeah, an extraordinarily unpleasant guy.
His bedside manner wasn't particularly great. Whenever.
No, no. I mean, he's a big fan of Peter Schiff.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's got a healthy. Let's put it this way.
And I was a huge fan of his, and he was,
yeah,
he still wasn't nice to me back.
Yeah, I met him.
He nailed the housing stuff.
Yeah, this is probably like 12, 13 years ago. I met him at the Money Show in Orlando, probably like 12, 13 years ago. And I was a little bit – no, it was 10 years ago. Excuse me, it was 10 years ago. No, 11. It was 2023 and beginning of 2023. Or excuse me, 2013. And yeah, so just, yeah, 10, 11 years ago. And and I kind of fanboyed on him because I followed his stuff and he was just a jerk. Anyway, I'm not here to beat up on Peter Schiff, but just, you know, a little insight there. Another guy that fits that deal is Ken Fisher. He is a piece of work.
Let's just air all of your grievances.
Well, I mean, hey, you know.
So I got a Peter Schiff story for you.
Okay, well, let's do it. Yeah.
So reading all his stuff after the housing crisis, and for anyone that doesn't know, or if you're just used to like dismissing everything he says, and you probably should be, like he truly nailed it.
He drilled it.
And it wasn't like he just got the conclusion right. Like he got the whys right,
yeah,
along the way. So it was really impressive. And for me, like I just pure halo affected that. Like, oh, if he got that right, he'll get everything right.
100%.
He's just a seer, right?
Yep.
So like I moved to Northern California, a Sacramento suburb in 2011. And you want to talk about a bombed out housing market?
Oh,
utterly destroyed.
Yeah.
In California.
California, yeah.
And I remember looking at, in fact, one of the little town I was living in was famously like teetering on bankruptcy. It was making national headlines, even though it was like a tiny town. and obviously because all the real estate, you know, tax income had gone kaput. So I get there and I'm just firmly in the Peter Schiff camp that you can't reignite that bubble like that. There's like firmly in that camp. And he was hardcore about like, no way you can reinflate the housing bubble.
Yep.
So I actually look at a condo, a beautiful, like brand new 2-bedroom. And I'm like a single young dude. So it's perfect, right? Condo. Less than I can rent a crappy apartment for, like $95,000 selling price. And I'm just like, I can't pull the trigger. And the reason is because I'm frozen on Peter's like, no reinflating the housing bubble comment. And I'm gonna look him up while we're doing the show, but I bet that condo's at least 300 now. So it's
probably
3x'd in whatever that is, like 12, 13 years.
Yeah, probably.
And
outperform the market.
Every time I think about that, I do think about Mr. Schiff and the views that I adopted that cost me that money.
Yeah, and it's one of the most dangerous things that I've found, honestly, is being right at a big turn. It's one of the most dangerous things because it is the very rare guy who can then flip positive when it's time to be positive, right? Because you saw it, you differentiated yourself because you saw it, you profited off of it. And it goes along the lines of thinking, what, you know, and I'm not the first person to say this. As a matter of fact, and I'm blanking out who was the first person to say it, or at least who gets credited with it. But, you know, when it's evident in our process, when you and I sit back and we're talking about things, we very seldom reference, you know, our discussions or our investment decisions around things that we've gotten right.
Yeah, there's not that much value in it.
No, there's not. And what we constantly discuss is ways that we've gotten it wrong in the past and how to avoid making those mistakes again. And that's kind of what you learn. You learn it in life too, which is, you know, I give Tony Greer a lot of credit for that, right? He and I said this as much the last couple of times we had him on, where, you know, he was pounding on the table. Much like I was, much like you were at that time, going into 2022 about short tech, long energy. And toward the end of that year, he flipped short energy, long tech.
Yeah.
And that's just tough to do.
It really is.
It's really tough to do. It's so easy to get bought into the dogma of, especially of a working trade, and having that mental dexterity to flip back the other way. It was exactly the right call. And more importantly, it was a right call that I should have made, that I didn't make in anywhere. I mean, we didn't abandon, we didn't get caught on completely the wrong side, but I didn't follow through with my own investment plan. You and I have talked about that before. You got to be careful with the wins. And that sounds funny, but
this should make you wildly defensive just internally in your own mind, like, and really on guard.
Yep. Yep.
It reminds me of it's a Raoul Powell saying that I really like. He said it's basically when you think your crap doesn't stink, that's when the market will rub your nose in it.
And yep,
it's a perfect way.
Yeah, no, it's and yeah.
Winning trades, like, you just don't learn anything because you just assume like I'm smart and I got it right.
Yep.
But losing trades, like, you just have to go dig into it to figure out how you mess it up, and you always learn a lot from that.
Yep. You always learn a lot about it. That's why we have the saying around here, which certainty is the hallmark of the charlatan.
The one thing I will say, though, on a winning trade, this is something I'm trying to touch on my podcast a lot with other investors, is like, if you get something right for the wrong reason,
it's the worst.
It like you better do the work on that. So like I just said, like, if you get a trade right, you just assume you're smart and you got it right. But sometimes you got a trade right and it had nothing to do with why you thought it would go up. And
100%.
It's so important to like recognize that and kind of pick that apart. And as a researcher, like I try really hard to like own that. Like I've had the backslaps from clients, you know, like that was a great call. And like, actually, if you go back and read that, why we went up has nothing to do with what I said. Like,
right.
My thesis didn't even work out. It just, some other stuff happened and yeah, it went up, but like.
Now I will say this though.
Happy to accept those.
Well, and it's a big part of risk management, meaning, you know, and again, it's something that we talk about all the time. It's one of the reasons why I think buying things that, you know, in some obviously every setup is different, right? There's times where we've had huge wins on buying companies that weren't solid, but it went from completely garbage to just not good, right? There have been those scenarios. But I think it's not as popular to talk about, certainly, as AI these days. But that's one of the nice things about buying things that are bombed out that have a ton of value, right? Meaning it allows you to take some of those, you know, we've all seen it where you buy these positions and you're like, look, I'm buying this position because I think it's going to go up for a variety of different reasons. I've done my homework, all that kind of stuff. But the other reason why I'm cool to pull the trigger here is this thing is completely bombed out, yep. Right? And therefore that which massively lowers my downside risk, right? And it just makes it easier to manage it, you know, because you get things bombed out to a certain level and you can tell, again, everything is different, but you're like, okay, if it breaks from here, something's really wrong, right? Sure. Like you kind of know where you're at there. But that's where that whole, like I said, that's where the fundamental part of it comes back in, because when you buy things cheap, good things can happen, even things that, you know, aren't what you were thinking about, you know, or exactly. That were outside of your thesis.
It's like if you owned oil and because it was cheap, like, Did the Russians, you know, invading Ukraine help you? Yes. Did you see that coming? No. But one of the reasons you bought was you had that margin of safety. And to me, the modern margin of safety really is just bombed out. Because like the Ben Graham buying things for like half of their cash value, like that died a long time ago. It's not even a thing anymore.
Yeah.
But what still is a thing is finding something that no one's cared about and has just gone down or sideways for the last 3 or 5 years.
Yep. Yep. And then like you and I've talked about, like, it's the irony of this crazy market is I actually think it's a pretty target rich environment for that, because the total domination of one sector with retail and the market and market caps and ETFs and all that kind of stuff, even though you haven't been in a recession, it's created recessionary like conditions and prices in some of these other sectors, right? Where you're looking at them and going, look, people may not like this, but on a cash basis, this is a phenomenal investment. You know, if I'm throwing off 15 to 20% free cash flow, you know, with net cash on the balance sheet and I'm buying something for 4 to 6 or 7 times earnings, you know, the investment outlook is pretty good over the next 3 to 5 years.
Right.
You know, especially when you look at the condition we're in and, you know, if it's an oil producer looking at oil, right? Is oil bounced a little bit? Yeah. But I mean, think about it. We're looking at $80 to $85 oil in this environment. Right? Like oil, it ended 2007, hit 145.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? I mean, like, it's bombed out, right? And you're not going to hear people on CNBC talking about that because it's not a popular narrative. But, you know, I mean, and now things can obviously change really quick, but going to oil in particular, don't you kind of feel like oil is one of those deals where in this day and age, if you're buying oil sub 100, it's probably going to be a good buy over. Or maybe I shouldn't say buying oil. If you're buying oil producers sub 100, if you're picking good ones, they're probably going to be a pretty good bet over the next 5 years.
Yeah, I think if you buy them 75 to 100, it's a good buy, and if you buy them 50 to 75, it's a great buy.
Yeah, yeah.
And with a caveat of like over 150, you should probably be selling. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
giving a bunch of it back. But
yeah. Yeah, because it's funny how that relationship with all this inflation has happened, but the relationship and the price sensitivity to oil really hasn't seemed to adjust it too much. You know what I mean? Like what was the top of the cycle? 165? Did we get that high? 160?
I'd have to look.
Anyway, you don't have to look. I mean, we were somewhere between 150 and 165. Yeah, somewhere in there. And what's funny is you really start seeing demand get impacted, remember?
Yeah. I would say you got a little bit of it at that like 150-ish area. And it started to weigh on the economy though, like in general. That seemed clear to me. And I think a huge part of the economy doing well last year was the fact that oil went down. Huge.
Yeah, that was another thing Tony Greer hit. And you said it as well last year, which was that people are really underestimating what the loosening of financial conditions and oil falling does for the economy.
Yeah, and hey, like even we might be doing the opposite right now. Like, hey, gasoline prices are ticking back up to like around 4. That's going to do the opposite. That's going to start messing, you know, with retail sales and stuff.
Well, yeah, but that's stuff that's negative. So, you know, that's not fun. That's just bears. That's just bears. That's another funny thing too, man. Talk about an unpopular environment to be a bear. And we're not bearish, and so I get that. I mean, I'm, you know, we're not bearish because we think everything's great. I still love those arguments, guys. Economy booming. I love that. You know what I mean? Like there are parts, right? We've talked about this enough, but I'm like, yeah. Like I said, it's like putting a, you know, it's like putting a Toyota Corolla or whatever, like on jet fuel and nitrous oxide and being like, oh man, look at that thing run. You're like, yeah, it doesn't make it a big block VA, baby.
I'd say the training wheels are bigger than the real wheels.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. What else we have? Not really a big move in rates or anything to really speak of.
It was really no data today. I was, yeah, mortgage applications, which weren't great. That was it. So slow day.
What do you think that, where are we at as far as the data lining up for a cut? Do you think the first cut comes in May?
I do think it could come in May, but only if you get a downside surprise on jobs, inflation, or both, or like a really ugly retail sales print. Other than some pretty bad data, I think they'd wait till June. June's the one that's priced. They like to, you know, they like to hang out in the one that's priced. So I think that being the most likely scenario at the moment, yes. But flip side, you get another hot one that starts putting pressure on them to push out past June.
What do we make of the VIX, if anything, at this point? Is it significant? Are there any levels we've gone? Again, volatility. It's amazing to have watched volatility change in this cycle, right? Like 15 used to be cheap vol.
To me, like,
it just feels like there's a magnet back to like 10 on the VIX now. It just won't stay.
It feels like a beach ball where like you're going to 10 or you're going to like 40.
Yeah.
You don't get to just go to 18 and then come back. Like,
no.
Because I think it's going to take something to like kind of snap to break a lot of these correlations and a lot of the systematic money that's all crowded into the same types of vol suppressing trades. But yeah, I mean, it's very, very, very low.
And it's important to
back to a 12 hand.
Yeah. And it's important to remember, and just take it from me. It is important to remember why, right? Like vol is low in a perverse way that makes sense because so much money is being pumped into the system. So do not make the same mistake, which is, well, then that means it's a great time to buy vol hand over fist because vol is cheap. Yes, vol is cheap, but it's cheap for a reason.
And vol is a melting ice cube. So
yeah.
It's a speculation that if you make, like you're doing so knowing that it essentially has a bunch of negative carry.
Yep.
So
yep. Which
is something to play with very much.
No. And again, another tip to save you some money. If you ever want to use vol, which I think it can be incredibly useful to use to hedge your portfolio, you always have to have parameters around the trade and a time limit on the trade. Meaning one of the things we talk about is if we're going to deploy vol, it needs to be circumstantially specific, right? Meaning because we're concerned about this issue, when this issue passes with if nothing comes up, then we will dump it immediately, right? Because you just cannot, I mean, yeah. Anybody doing this professionally knows this, but for any of you that are doing that at home, like just let me save you a lot of money. Don't buy vol just because it's cheap.
Yeah. I mean, even the best vol traders in the world have really struggled in the last couple
of years. Oh man. I mean, we both know, not personally, but we both know of several, you know, people that we've got, you know, similar relationships with and things like that. Guys that we know in the industry that ran vol funds that have been shut down.
Right.
They had to shut themselves down because it's been such a brutal environment. But you've said that the move index, fixed income volatility has collapsed as well, right?
Yeah, fixed income vol is low. Currency vol is low. But against those, equity vol is even that much lower. Now, within the S&P, like you get a little higher when you go out to small caps and stuff like that. But I mean, S&P vol, you could easily go back and carry an 11 handle before long. But and I know I sound like a broken record, but it just takes that one thing to kind of hit the first domino or jingle block, you know, and kind of next thing you know, you really could be on a move to 30, 40 just because. So
in the blink of an eye.
Right.
Well, because
I'm not seeing another Volmageddon thing. That's been a little oversold lately, but
once,
there is a shocking amount of people selling it.
Once again, I was making an equivalency to this on AMC. Right. Like people are still playing the AMC short squeeze.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I'm like, listen, guys, one of the reasons it's not going to happen is because everybody's aware of what you're talking about. right? When GME blew, it caught everybody off guard, right? You, if you think another hedge fund is going to take 65 to 70% losses on AMC puts, you're out of your mind.
Right.
It's, they're not going to make the same mistake again. And it's what, you know, we always talk about the generals fighting the last war, right? It's just not going to happen again. People, markets learn. They're amazingly limber when it comes to learning and catching on to trends and tricks. And it's just not going to happen. And I didn't want to get into the fundamental part of it, but like when you looked at, and I'll just say it as a guy that was in it and made a pile on GameStop. When you looked at GameStop, you could see the thesis for a short squeeze back in 2016, right? I mean, and it came down to this: net cash and positive cash flow. Yes, it was a melting ice cube, but it was a profitable melting ice cube. And anytime a company's got a pile of net cash and positive cash flow, it gives them the ability to do things that could potentially burn shorts. You flip around and you look at a company like AMC that's diluting the heck out of its shareholders and can't get cash. Like, it's in a completely different scenario, right? And anyway, it's just, it goes back to comparing past things to nothing is ever the same, right? It's, and I don't mean it's not going to be different this time. I mean, anytime you're analyzing a company, I think it's one of the biggest mistakes people can make in investing is, of course, this time's the same, but also expecting things to play out exactly like they have in the past. And it's just never the way it works. It's never the way it works. Okay. So closing up here, you know, I would say it feels to me like you're in a similar situation that you've been for the majority of the last, certainly the last 3 years. And I think probably even further than that, last, you know, 12 to 15, meaning I think we're kind of in this default space of market, prove it to us. Is the Fed going to cut? But when we've been in that default space, that has been exactly when that grind higher just keeps going and going and going. Yeah. Right. And
the market loves to be like about to get a cut, especially when the economy's not terrible.
Yeah. Well, and especially when I think that you have more investors ever today aware of the power of the Fed and what interest rate cuts mean. Like, and I would love to put a survey out there. I don't know what you could compare it to, but I just flat out guarantee you right now, if you did a big old wide survey across a big body of investors, more people today would correlate Fed intervention and interest rate cuts with markets going up than at any other time in the past.
Yeah, no doubt.
You know, people are aware of that. That genie is out of the bottle. People have a full effect of, or have a full knowledge of who the Fed is and what they're doing.
The funny thing about that is I'm like of two minds on like, we wildly overestimate how much it matters. But I'm also of the same mind of like, it matters more than some people pretend. Like some people are like, I don't really watch the Fed. Like, well then you're messing up because the market's literally gone straight up since they pivoted, like from that day. Because the Waller speech that really kind of marked the pivot before the big pivot, since then we've just gone straight up. So like, if you don't pay attention to that, like what have you done to yourself?
Yeah, I don't know.
But on the flip side, like we've talked about yesterday, like I think liquidity is more important than the interest rates themselves.
Yeah.
Now, if you're a Fed watcher and you're watching both closely, that's different. But
well, and Druckenmiller's talked about this for a long time. And I think that people are trying to discredit him to some degree because they're like, oh, rates went up. Yes, rates went up, but liquidity didn't go down. Right. And what he was really talking about, and this is kind of what I was alluding to the other day, is I used to sort of, what I realized when I was talking about interest rates, that what I was really talking about was liquidity. And I just didn't know it.
Yeah. That's a great way of saying it.
Right. And at the end of the day, when consistently more money is pumping into a system than is going out, things are going to rise. It's just, again, it's the bathtub analogy. Yes, you got a hole in the bathtub, but you got a higher flow faucet and it's just pumping faster than liquid can escape. And we've seen this time and time again over the last 15 years, and you're going to have your shocks, you're going to have your naysayers, you're going to have your bears. But that when you're in that scenario and the money's flowing, it's just that grind higher, right? Especially the one thing that we've talked about it right now, you're kind of in that Goldilocks. I hate using that term, but you are, because that the one thing that could throw that off, and I think when you got to start really paying attention to it, is if we start seeing unemployment claims climb. Not because that means it's a big recession or collapse about to happen, but that could, I would think that that could potentially disrupt that positive constant flow into 401ks, right, on a weekly or biweekly basis. Right. But until, like, and again, we were saying this yesterday, again, one of the things we've learned is keep it as close of an eye on the environmental factors as you do the underlying securities, because, you know, objects in motion tend to stay in motion. Until something changes in the environment, the thing that you're watching happening is probably going to continue.
100% markets trend.
Yep.
That's what, it's one of the things that makes them, like, you can actually make money in them using charts, is because we know they literally trend. Like, that's a fact.
Yeah. And the one thing, and you and I have talked about this too, and just to kind of give people an insight, and we'll see if we're right or we're wrong. But honestly, for me, I think when I'm going to be the most cautious about a violent pullback is in the immediate aftermath of the first Fed cut.
Yes. That's something people have been talking about lately. And like, to me, like, that makes a lot of sense. And it's like the ultimate sell the news. But I think you're right. As long as the market's chasing this first cut, I think it's hard for it to go down. But after you get the first one, especially if you get a first one that looks like a one and done kind of big pause thing, then yeah, like that then you'd have to grapple with, well, rates are actually still really high. You know, so you have to start thinking, like, even if they cut three times, like, rates are still really high. Like, that's still,
to me, a lot of it will be dependent on the market reaction. And you were making this point today, and I was pushing back on it a little bit, but I can definitely see where you're coming from. And I don't discount it at all, which is, it's going to be very interesting to watch the interest rate complex when they finally do cut, because, like you mentioned, in a perverse way, it could send, I keep using that term, I just feel like it's really appropriate these days, but in a perverse way, remember, when the Fed cuts, it has an immediate impact on the front end of the curve. It doesn't have an immediate impact on the back. And you could see the long end bust loose to the upside scenario.
The knock on is, I mean, if it happened with the conditions we have now, or especially if the next inflation print's pretty warm, they're implying, like, we don't care about that 2% target we told you about, and that we especially don't care about it anytime soon. Like, that's the kind of thing that the back end, like, should care more about, you know, growth and inflation than it cares about the, you know, the policy rate. So that it at least, it makes sense to me that it could take a look at that and go, you know what, there's no reason, 2 year you can go down, but I'm not, because you're playing with inflationary fire here.
Yeah. Yeah. We know, like, that. And that'll be interesting.
While the Fed's not in there buying them.
Well, yeah. And then that could be the fuel for a sell-off too. You get the back end of the curve breaking loose. You could have that sell the news pressure, and then also the back end of the curve breaking loose,
which would just double down on the sell the news pressure.
Yep. Yep.
And then everyone would be scratching their head and confused, but in reality, it would make sense.
Well, it would make, especially in this market, right? Like, just meaning, you know, when the victory cries reach a zenith and the Fed finally does cut, it wouldn't surprise me to see. Because at the end of the day, if you do see the back end of the curve go up, you have to respect that at that point. Because the back end of the curve, if they lose control of it, everything's going to start blowing up. Now, they'll step in and intervene before that happens. But that is a real issue. You know, if you get the 30-year pop into six and a half, I mean, that's a problem.
Absolutely.
Right. So anyway, guys, well, that's about it today. We will be back tomorrow, as always, to keep taking this journey, adding another dot to the dot plot and walking through it. So we'll see you tomorrow. And then we've got hoping to get this interview out by the end of this week. But we got some great interviews up on tap. Booking an interview with Jared Dillon.
Oh, nice.
Right now. He'll be fun to have on. I've never had him on here, and he's a fun commentator, man. I think he's a bright guy and also a good communicator as well.
He's a straight shooter and minimal filter, which
those are
good people to have.
Yep, absolutely. So hopefully you guys will enjoy that. But until then, we'll see you tomorrow. You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
The opinions expressed in this program are for general informational purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or on any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember, investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Investment advice cannot be given without a client service agreement. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Trek Financial, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor.